There are moments in your life, few and far between, when you find yourself in the same room as someone whose voice once echoed through history, and yet whose eyes now reflect the weight of the future. He walked in without a fuss. No motorcade, no handlers. Just a tall man with creased brows and the calm of someone who has said, "I told you so," more times than he'd like to count. This wasn't Washington. This was Nairobi, a city breathing beneath smog and bougainvillea. He had come not to preach, but to reckon with all of it. Al Gore, former Vice President of the United States, Nobel laureate, global climate conscience, had sat down with me for a conversation that was less about politics and more about the soul of a planet in peril. So no, this is not your normal interview. This is a story of power and failure, and maybe, if we're lucky, redemption. I'm Steve Mokaya, and this is the Nature Trail Podcast.
There's no reason for USAID. When you look at the politicians that have been in there sucking the blood out of it, when you look at all of the fake deals, I mean, look, it's fake, it's fraudulent, it's probably kickbacks. When we have $36 trillion in debt, and we're taking care of countries that are very rich and sending aid to countries in some cases that are rich, in some cases they're not rich. But no, it should very much decrease.
You could feel the frustration in the room before a single question was asked. Because when the US, the wealthiest polluter on earth, pulls funding from Africa's most vulnerable climate programs, what you are left with is a budget gap, and dry riverbeds, and failed harvests, and empty boreholes, and people. People who did everything right, still staring down the barrel of a drought they didn't cause. So, I asked Al Gore, what does justice look like when the richest countries turn their backs?
Recently, since President Trump came to office, he scrapped the USAID, which was funding a lot of mitigation measures in Africa. And now, so many programs are not running, which were to mitigate the impact of climate and the extremities of the weather, you know. So what do you have to say about that?
I'm sorry. As an American, I certainly did not vote for Donald Trump. I wish he had not been elected. We have 3.5 years more to get through. It's regrettable that he has cut off some of the assistance that is based on justice and fairness and on our common effort to create a brighter future. I wish there were another election tomorrow to vote him out of office, but we have to wait 3.5 years. In the meantime, there is a chance that our subnational leaders, the governors of states, the mayors of cities, the leaders of companies that have integrity, can limit some of the damage Donald Trump appears determined to do. The Congress, we won't have to wait 3.5 years to see a change in the Congress. We have elections for the House of Representatives every 2 years. And for one-third of the Senate every 2 years. And 1.5 years from now, we will have those elections. We call them midterm elections, halfway through the term of a president. And I think there's a real chance that we'll see significant improvements in U.S. policy after the midterm elections, 1.5 years from now. In the immediate aftermath of World War II, the United States of America became, in the eyes of many, the most powerful nation in the world and the wealthiest nation in the world. There is an old saying that I heard when I was growing up, perhaps you did as well, to whom much is given, much is required. And I think that that embodies a principle of justice that the United States should continue to respect. Now, it's been a long time since the end of World War II, and there have been many changes. The Chinese economy has grown quite dramatically. The U.S. Share of global wealth has declined. We are still the most powerful and wealthiest country, however, and I think we should continue to play the kind of global leadership role that we have played for the last 75 years. That is my view. There should have been a more gradual transition, and certainly today, there should be a pathway to make a transition that doesn't hurt and harm so many people who have come to depend on USAID. Maybe over a longer period of time, other nations could find ways to fill that gap, but to do it suddenly is cruel. It's cruel, and I do not support it. And I'm sorry that he has made these decisions.
They meet every year, these men and women in tailored suits and country pins, at grand hotels in cities with airports big enough to land the future. They call it COP, Conference of Parties. But increasingly, it feels like a masquerade, because outside the press rooms and breakfast buffets, the very companies choking the planet are busy writing the script. God doesn't hide his disdain for it.
I have quite loudly advocated for serious reforms in the COP process, even before Dubai and Baku, but certainly in Dubai at COP28 and in Baku last year at COP29. I vociferously argued we have to reform this process. It has been, to an unhealthy degree, captured by the fossil fuel polluters. The very fact that the CEO of one of the biggest and dirtiest oil companies on the planet was installed as the head of COP28 is ridiculous and absurd. The fact that the number of fossil fuel company delegates outnumber the combined delegations of the 10 nations that are most harmed by the climate crisis is absurd and unjust.
Absurd, yes, but also deeply revealing. Because if the fireman hands the matchbox to an arsonist, you have to ask, who are we really protecting? There is a danger that creeps in through silence. It doesn't kick down doors. It signs them shut with lobbyist ink. So I asked him, why is progress on climate so impossibly slow? And his answer cut deeper than emissions charts or pledges broken, because the real problem, he said, isn't carbon, it is capture.
We need reforms in the process. Now, the fossil fuel industry and the petrostates, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, you know the others, they have captured control of the process to a very unhealthy degree. That needs to be changed. I've advocated for specific reforms. We should not require unanimity in order to adopt policies. That's one of the reasons why it took 28 COPs before they could even mention the principal cause of the crisis, fossil fuels. And then in COP28, they finally mentioned fossil fuels. And then in COP29, they got rid of it again. It's frustrating to all of us, I include myself in the community of activists who have been trying to mobilize solutions for this crisis.
In other words, the planet isn't dying because we don't know what to do. It's dying because the people in charge know and choose not to. If you want to know who carries the weight of the climate crisis, don't look to the podium. Look to the kitchen, the water point, the field. Look to the women who nurse hungry children through failed rains, who walk farther for less water, who plant food in soil that barely remembers what rain feels like. Ask Algo about this imbalance.
I think the evidence supports the view that women are, on average, more affected by the climate crisis than men, perhaps because of their typically larger role in caring for young children. It's not always the case, but on average that is the case. And I think that that may be part of it. And of course, in many countries, including my own, there is a history of discrimination against women. The recent progress has been very, very inspiring to people who have paid attention to it, and I think it is changing. But still, women are discriminated against. It's a sign that we still have work to do on eliminating discrimination.
Then, almost like remembering a melody, he mentioned a name. A name that stirs something sacred in this country called Kenya.
I will say, however, that one of the most inspiring and effective leaders I have ever met on climate in my life was the late Wangari Maathai from Kenya. She inspired me. I was privileged to become a close friend. She visited my home in Tennessee in the U.S. Her daughter Wanjira is here today, of course, and continues her mother's tradition of leadership. So I think it very much depends on the individual women involved and the communities involved. But I don't disagree that women still face, on average, a burden of discrimination and should be allowed to play as big a role in shaping climate policy as they wish.
He smiled softly, as though speaking of a sister in the fight. And maybe that is the lesson, that in the climate struggle, the fiercest warriors often come wearing head wraps, not neckties. Some things never change. The names evolve from empires to markets, from traders to consultants. But the game is old. Pastorates in Kenya have begun raising their voices, communities in Uganda and Namibia too. They say the new gold rush isn't oil, it is air. Carbon credits, sold by the ton, traded across oceans, and often bought at the cost of ancestral land. So ask Al Gore, is this justice?
There has been a history of abuses where carbon credits are concerned. And one of the abuses has been a failure to integrate the viewpoints of those in the communities that are affected. If they do not have input, if their experiences and points of view are not involved in shaping a plan for carbon credits, then that's unjust. And climate justice is justice, and we have to pursue it. There is also a second series of source of abuse with carbon credits, and that is there is such an asymmetry, an imbalance between the demand for carbon credits from the wealthy countries of the West and companies that have pledged to reduce their emissions, and they think the easy way to do it would be to buy carbon credits. That demand is very large compared to a much smaller supply of carbon credits that really have integrity, and that not only have integrity but also have full participation from the local communities in the design of those credits. So that history of abuse makes me very skeptical of many carbon credits.
It is not a question of intention, he said. It is about power. Who gets to define value? Who gets to sign the deals? Who gets to disappear? And perhaps the most damning truth?
And the biggest problem I have with carbon credits, one of the biggest problems, the fact that local communities are sometimes not consulted and not involved, and they have to suffer the damage, that's just as big a problem. But another big problem is that some of the carbon credits proposed in the past have simply been an excuse to allow the polluters to continue to pollute. And the number one objective has to be to reduce emissions. Look, we're in a global crisis here. This thin shell of atmosphere, we're all trapped inside of it. And we're using it as an open sewer, and it's trapping so much extra heat. It is really doing serious damage to the ecological systems that we depend upon, that our children and grandchildren will depend upon. So if they're using some trickery to pretend that they're reducing emissions and not actually doing it, That's terrible. It ought to be outlawed. It ought to be prevented.
Here is the sharpest edge of the climate debate. Should Africa, the continent least responsible for global emissions, be asked to walk away from its fossil fuels? Uganda finds oil, Kenya floods with coal, and suddenly the West calls foul. I asked him, isn't that hypocrisy?
Of course, African nations have a right to develop as they choose to develop. But I would urge them to listen to the young people in Africa. In the case of Uganda, to young people like Vanessa Nakate, who have done the research and who have learned the lessons of history. And I would say this, I'll take my own country as an example. If 150 years ago, when we began the rapid economic development, if at that time the cheapest source of electricity was solar electricity, we would have used it. If we had electric vehicles instead of the smog-producing, petrol-burning vehicles, we would have used them. If we had wind and batteries, we would have used that instead of creating all the pollution-based problems and the poverty and the resource curse that has so frequently been associated with the development of fossil fuels. Look at Nigeria, for example. The history of the environment being left poisoned and destroyed, people harmed, their health ruined, driven into poverty, with the wealth from those fossil fuels going not to the people, but to a very small number of wealthy elites, and mostly to those who are extracting from the fossil fuels from Africa and selling it to Europe and Asia and elsewhere. That's why so many call it fossil fuel colonialism.
He pointed to Nigeria, where oil poisoned the land and padded the pockets of the few. He pointed to history, where fossil fuel wealth brought pollution, corruption, and the curse of dependency. But most of all, he pointed to the youth, not as victims of the future, but as prophets of a better path.
I would urge the African leaders who speak about a right to develop fossil fuels to listen to their own young people who have learned the history and who, in my view, are pointing to a better pathway to develop in a clean way. Also, the climate crisis is a global issue, and every nation that takes a look at what the impact is, and it's been very harsh on Kenya, knows that we have to reduce the global warming pollution before it destroys our civilization.
So I ask the question I always save for the end. Are you still hopeful? He paused. You could almost hear him checking his heart. And then he nodded. Not like a politician, but like a man who's seen just enough light in the smoke to believe.
There is an old saying attributed to an economist in the U.S. years ago, Rudy Dornbusch. It's known as Dornbusch's Law. And that law says this, things take longer to happen than you think they will, but then they happen faster than you thought they could. We've seen that in technology. We've seen that sometimes in politics as well. When the struggle to give women the right to vote was underway, there were many who thought, oh, we'll never be able to succeed. But then when the heart of the issue was revealed as a choice between right and wrong, all of a sudden it happened quickly. Abolition of slavery, the same pattern. And I think we're very close to that point where the climate crisis is concerned. I think we are going to win this struggle. I do believe, however, that there is an open question as to whether or not we will win it in time to avoid truly catastrophic consequences. I believe we will, but it depends upon how quickly we can accumulate the sufficient political will to make the policy changes. Stop forcing taxpayers to subsidize the dirtiest source of energy in the world, fossil fuels. Come up with a fair and just way of allocating investment capital around the world so that developing nations can participate fully the way the wealthy countries have. I think that these changes are in the works. I know that advocates are gaining ground. If you look at all of the new electricity generation installed worldwide last year, many people are surprised to learn that 93% of it was solar and wind. That's amazing. If you look at how the cost for pollution-free renewable energy has come down so quickly, it's really amazing. And these positive changes also give me hope.
He spoke of solar panels blanketing rooftops in Ghana, of wind farms turning in Turkana, of Afghan youth who've stopped asking for permission and started acting.
The biggest source of hope for me are the climate activists here in Africa. They are so energetic. They've taken the time to educate themselves, to network with one another, and to learn how to communicate and advocate skillfully. So it reminds me of Wangari Maathai, who I first met 35 years ago here in Nairobi. And I think they are following in her tradition.
Hope, it turns out, isn't a policy. It is a choice, a fight, a refusal. Al Gore did give us a silver bullet. He didn't sugarcoat the politics. He didn't pretend the battle is won. But he sat and spoke and listened. And maybe in this age of vanishing glaciers and vanishing truths, that's what leadership looks like. Not certainty, but conscious. I'm Steve Mokaya. This has been the Nature Trail Podcast. If this episode starts something in you, share it. Talk about it. Act on it. Because the earth is not dying quietly. It is speaking louder every day. The question, though, is, are we listening?